1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you're having a great Saturday. Hope we can make your Saturday even just a little bit better by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. Joining me to do so, as he does so very often on the show, please welcome from the Pop Culture Knowledge Channel on YouTube, Jeremy Branch.
Hey, what's going on? Glad to be here. Thank you all for checking out the show. We're always excited to be able to kind of share our love of things going on in the world of pop culture with you. And it's been a kind of big week in the world of Marvel trailers. So before we kick off the show with our regular kind of scheduled program, I wanted to get your temp on a couple of these new trailers that came out, Julio. We have Captain America Brave New World, and we had Agatha, Witch of Darkness or something.
Agatha All Along.
All right. And yeah. That one's coming out on September 18th. So I think we got a slightly closer release date on that one. You want to kick off the conversation with Agatha All Along?
Yeah, we should mention also that we're just like 2 weeks away from Deadpool and Wolverine opening up. So it makes sense that they're teasing some more Marvel content now, since this is the only Marvel movie we're going to get this year. That they're starting to ramp up the teasing for the stuff that's coming out later in the year on TV, and then the Captain America movie comes out in February, so early next year.
If I may, in regards to Agatha and Captain America, I think they did a good job of kind of putting us in this world without showcasing a whole lot of what's going on as far as like surprises that we may see. However, I feel like Deadpool and Wolverine is just showing way too much, and I think you've kind of made a conscious decision, or at least haven't decided to delve into all of those, right?
Yeah, I guess there's been a lot of like little mini trailers that have been put out that I've overall not watched. I did watch one just because it got a lot of hype on the internet, which wasn't really like too shocking that this character was in the movie, because it had been kind of out there and he'd kind of been glimpsed in one of the other trailers. And also, you know, you're making a Wolverine movie. If you're a Wolverine fan, you know who Wolverine's archenemy is.
Liev Schreiber.
Well, I mean, technically, yes. but that's not the actor that we're seeing. We're seeing another version of that character, though, who we have seen before. So, and I think we'd all like to forget that X-Men Origins Wolverine exists.
Yeah, unfortunately, because Schreiber was good, but we also love Tyler Mayne. He's actually come to Pensacon and been a guest there before, and is responsible for playing other great characters like Michael Myers in Rob Zombie's movies, which, you know, maybe a little bit more divisive. But, you know, he did a good job as Michael Myers.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Myers is kind of a hard thing to screw up.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Yeah. Just walk slow.
Walk slow, stand there menacingly, and occasionally stab some people.
Yeah. Maybe tilt your head a little bit, but yeah,
you don't ever say anything, so you know.
Yeah.
I feel like I could play Michael Myers.
That is a movie I would see.
I don't know if I could play Mike Myers, but I could play Michael Myers.
So that's kind of tip of the iceberg. That's just one of many cameos that have been released in these little tiny snippet teasers. And I don't love that, because I think there is something fun about the pop of the cameos in the Marvel movies. And, you know, Deadpool kind of references that in his meta breaking the fourth wall kind of way. But let's move back over to Agatha All Along. We got a 2-minute teaser trailer, and it, like we said, coming out September 18th on Disney Plus. This is kind of a follow up to WandaVision, and it's a return of a beloved character. I think Agatha was kind of one of the breakouts of WandaVision.
Oh, for sure.
What do you think about?
And I think going with that title makes some sense, because of course that was the big reveal song in WandaVision.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we've gone through like 5 different official titles on this show, because it was like,
is that right?
It was Agatha House of Harkness, and it was Agatha Darkhold Diaries, and it was there were like 3 or 4 other titles that were put out there as this is what the show's going to be called, And then they revealed, oh, no, it's actually not called all of those things. It's called Agatha All Along.
Well, that makes some sense as to my confusion about it.
Yeah. So I don't know what's going on with those titles, if they are any kind of indication of what's going to happen in the show. Mm-hmm. I thought the trailer was interesting. There's a lot of nods to famous horror movies and crime procedurals in it.
Yeah,
which,
yeah.
You know, if you watched WandaVision, obviously WandaVision had a lot of nods to a lot of historical sitcoms in it. So,
interesting. I didn't even think about that part.
Yeah, I'm thinking that's not accidental. I think it may have something to do with the spell that was cast on Westview that we saw in WandaVision, and maybe it's just kind of shifted. I did watch an analysis video on this that Screen Crush did that was very good.
Okay.
That really talked about some of the references to things as diverse as Mare of Easttown and Suspiria. So I'm interested in that. Of course, great cast in this, not just Catherine Hahn, who's a jewel, but one of my all-time favorites, Aubrey Plaza, is in this.
Always great.
Patti LuPone, Sasheer Zamata. We've got a character that appears to be the older version of one of Wanda's sons, which is a very key character in Marvel Comics. So that's interesting.
Is his
because
name Warlock?
Wiccan is the character's superhero name.
Okay.
It's going to be interesting to see because, you know, we've certainly had several allusions in the Marvel Universe, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, to the creation of a young Avengers team. Certainly very much teased at the end of the Marvels. And he would be a key character for that. He was a key character in the Young Avengers in the comics. So I guess that plan is still in place, which is good because I think that they've seeded a lot of characters throughout the course of various films that would make sense as being part of a Young Avengers film. And I feel like I'm getting ahead of myself with talking about that, and it gets into that whole, we don't want you to feel like you're doing homework here. But you know, for those of us who are those kinds of nerds, it's exciting.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a overall good trailer. WandaVision ended up being one of my favorite things that Marvel's put out on television, in particular the first half of the season, maybe even a little bit more than that. So if they can recapture some of that, I think we're on to a pretty exciting miniseries.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of snarky "who asked for this" comments on the internet, and it's like, first of all, if you don't want to watch it, don't watch it.
That's
but
a good point.
Getting on the internet and being a four-letter word for a male organ, you know, real fresh take there, guy. You know, just don't watch it. That's fine. It's perfectly okay if you don't want to watch it. I, on the other hand, do want to watch it. I loved WandaVision. I love Catherine Hahn. I'm here for it.
Kind of on the same note of recapturing what made the first so special, in the case of this next film, Captain America Brave New World, it looks to be kind of recapturing some of that espionage spirit that we saw in Captain America Winter Soldier, which obviously was the second in that at the time trilogy. Now there's a fourth entry into it, but it's not Steve Rogers. We get a good little dose of Harrison Ford as Thunderbolt Ross. There's a kind of clever little acknowledgement that he looks different at the beginning of the trailer. But I think this also looks like a lot of fun. I'm a big fan of all of the Captain America movies, and I think Sam Wilson as Captain America is a worthy kind of successor to the character. So I'm excited about this. I think that this one's got a lot of potential to be one of the more grounded Marvel movies, even though I do think we're going to end up having some really fantastical elements in it.
Well, I mean, there's no getting around the big red guy at the end of the trailer, and who, you know, you see his hand on the movie poster as well. We're getting Red Hulk in this.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's definitely going to be fantastical elements. That's been out there, so it wasn't that much of a surprise for him to pop up at the end of the trailer, because there's been some toys and such that have spoiled that. The trailer looks good. It doesn't give away a lot, and I like that about it.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see what this movie does. There's been a lot of reshoots on this, so we'll have to see. We got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. And Jeremy, man, I just loved it when that song kicked in and the opening credits of the new movie Maxine. Just such a perfect song choice for this movie and for the world this movie is set in, for the time period this movie is set in. It just sounded so good.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I like about Maxine, while we're on the topic of the music, is a lot of times when it comes to the fetishization of 80s pop culture, you expect the kind of Stranger Things approach to it. And I thought Maxine was cool in that it played a little bit more of like what you were actually hearing on the radio and in culture at the time. So instead of being like really synthy driven stuff, which is typical of movies that go back and revisit the 80s, I feel like having like some hair metal and a little bit of that kind of music in it made it feel real and very 80s in a way that we're not used to seeing and hearing.
Well, I mean, especially because, you know, L.A. was the capital of hair metal, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that for this movie to be set in L.A. and especially to be set in part against the world of adult film, but then it gets into the world of legit film and that whole like Hollywood lifestyle of the 80s. I think the songs that were chosen in this movie were chosen very, very well.
Absolutely.
You know, I actually just pulled up a quick list, and there's not a lot. It's not excessive either. This isn't just one of those films where there's needle drops for the sake of there being needle drops.
Mm-hmm.
The choices are very deliberate, and they're mostly diegetic. They're mostly, you know, things that are on the radio or whatever that the characters are hearing. It's not just, you know, there to, oh, look at me, I chose a clever song or anything like that.
Yeah.
But, and there's some like deep cuts in there too. Like they use I'm Insane by Rat. I don't think that was even a single, you know, they use Prisoner of Your Eyes by Judas Priest. Again, something I don't think was a single. And then, you know, a couple of more famous songs, In My House by the Mary Jane Girls, Obsession and Emotion. A couple of songs that were theme songs are used in other movies too. Cause I mean like St. Elmo's Fire, Man in Motion, that was the theme from St. Elmo's Fire, which there's also a little, you know, bit where they show a marquee with St. Elmo's Fire playing in a theater in the film too. And they even do, they even have the Casey Kasem voiceover from America's Top 40 the week that song hit number one.
Instantly recognizable. Casey Kasem is just one of those voices that for people of a certain generation, you hear it and it really puts you in a certain time and place. But if I may, let's back it up a little bit.
Yeah, and and I wanted to mention too, Shell Shock by New Order used in a very key scene towards the end of the movie. And that was very famously, that song wasn't on a New Order album. It was on the Pretty in Pink soundtrack.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, it was. I just thought those, especially using songs that were associated with other films, was an interesting choice, I thought.
So Maxine is the third entry into Ty West. I guess we're going to call it the Maxine Trilogy. Ty West is like a kind of small indie filmmaker with obvious horror roots. And this movie kind of concludes the Maxine story up to this, you know, the point when this movie's set. Is the follow-up to the film X and the follow-up to the film Pearl. Stars Nina Goth. We've also got Giancarlo Esposito, Kevin Bacon, and probably some other recognizable people that I'm overlooking.
Oh, well, Elizabeth Debicki for sure.
Playing, fantastic.
Yeah, playing a very key role in this, Michelle Monaghan. Why is his name just gone out of my head? Bobby Cannavale.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So this movie is set, obviously, as we've alluded to, in the 1980s. Maxine is an aspiring actress, legitimate actress, who has spent her time kind of working her way through the adult film industry. This one ties directly to X in a way that Pearl did not. So it's kind of the conclusion of the story that was started in part one. I think it's definitely got some like Diallo influence in it. You can feel the Argento on it. I mean, to the point that the killer wears the black gloves and you get a lot of like first-person views of it. I think it was a great way to wrap up the trilogy, Julio.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk a little bit more about the trilogy a little later in the film, later in the,
absolutely,
in the show. But I want to just kind of start out focusing on this film, which I really liked, which I really liked a lot. And all of those aspects are there. And yeah, there's definitely horrific elements to this movie, but I would go so far as to say that this is not a horror movie in the traditional sense. Like, I think this film is really more of a product of the 80s. This is like a revenge thriller that you would see in the 80s. And I think that the films that it has the most in common with is probably a relatively obscure series of films called Angel. The first one was Angel, and the second one was Avenging Angel. And if you were around in the 80s, even if you didn't see these movies, you definitely saw the advertisements for them. You saw the posters for them in the video stores. It was a big VHS hit because it was one of those very titillating kind of things, you know, where the lead character was a high school honor student by day and a Hollywood hooker by night. And the poster had the split screen image of her, one with the goody-goody high school student, the other one where she's, you know, dressed in, you know, scantily clad and kind of, you know, looks like she's walking the street, which she was. And that movie was very much a, you know, there's a killer on the loose and he's stalking, you know, all of her friends and she's, you know, she's got to take revenge. And then there was another one of these movies. But yeah, so I mean, also has, you know, a lot in common with movies like Death Wish and, you know, that kind of like 80s vigilante justice kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe like you would call them exploitation flicks. A lot of the stuff that Quentin Tarantino was heavily influenced by, which you can kind of see that.
It's totally Grindhouse. I mean, it's just a different kind of Grindhouse than like a slasher, which X was very clearly a slasher. This is more of a, you know, here's the dirty underbelly of Hollywood. And, you know, despite the fact that I think I almost wonder if it's not undermined a little bit by the fact that the success of the first two movies has really enabled Ty West to draft some heavyweight actors in this film.
Okay.
Because, I mean, if you think about it, if you saw X, like the actor, Mia Goth has become a big name now, but she was not a big name when that film was made. Probably the biggest name in that movie was not really a big name at the time, and that's Jenna Ortega.
Yeah.
You know, that was one of the films that kind of helped start to make her a big name, but she wasn't that big a name at the time. I think, you know, same with Pearl, you know, yeah, we're in a year, everybody's going to know who David Corenswet is when he comes out with a big red S on his chest.
Yeah.
But, you know, right now, you know, or at the time Pearl came out for that matter, David who?
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, this film, we do, as we mentioned, have a lot of very established names in this film. So, I mean, you know, I think probably Kevin Bacon more so than anybody else. And so
I
kind of wonder if you're going for that Grindhouse vibe. Do you think to some extent having those famous faces in the film detracts from that a little bit?
That's an interesting question. It hadn't really occurred to me until you mentioned it, but you can see where maybe putting the higher caliber actors in it does kind of, in a meta sense, detract from it. But I didn't feel that way. Maybe when you kind of look at the critical reception of this, when you have to wonder is, were the expectations higher? Was the bar all of a sudden higher when you do put in actors with such like a, you know, high pedigree?
See, and I don't think that's too much the case because the reviews are good on this film.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was, you know, it's certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes and all that good stuff. The critics do seem to like it. I don't think it's been quite as praised as X and Pearl were. And I don't think that's unfair. I think it's a strong ending to the trilogy, but if I had to pick my favorite film in the series, it probably wouldn't be this one.
Well, let's come back around to it in the next segment.
Yeah, I mean, but that being said, I loved it. I think that Mia Goth is fantastic. I think everybody's good in it. I think Bacon does run the risk of going a little over the top with his Louisiana swamp rat private detective character, but I think he keeps it within bounds.
In a fun way, I think. And Kevin Bacon's been having quite a week, well, last week in particular, with the release of Axel F. and Maxine, both in the same week, and it's cool to see him back. He is definitely a fixture of the 1980s, so that thematically both of those roles work for him. I also think it's funny that, and this is just a tiny little bit of trivia, but the Rambo knife was actually featured in Axel F. and Maxine, which is just like a weird little thing. I wonder if Kevin Bacon carries it around with him or something.
Well, I mean, that is an iconic knife of that period. So, I mean, they did sell them in stores. So, you know, I mean, it makes sense that, you know, people saw it on screen and then they wanted to have one. So it makes sense that people would have those walking around in the 80s to some extent. We got to take a break. We're going to be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us online from the Pop Culture Knowledge channel on YouTube. That's another deep cut that I was just really pleased to hear on the soundtrack for Maxine. The title song from Frankie Goes to Hollywood's debut album, Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. When is the last time you have heard a Frankie Goes to Hollywood song that was not Relax?
I don't think I've ever heard a Frankie Goes to Hollywood song that was not Relax.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, maybe you see somebody use Two Tribes here and there, but I mean, a great song that was a number one hit in the UK that, you know, was just a dance club track here. So
it is a great track.
Yeah, and just used so well in this movie for a great dance club scene where Maxine gets up in, you know, full 80s regalia, complete with like an adamant stripe across her eyes. Like
awesome.
She's out of a Duran Duran video or something. And I just, the aesthetic of this movie, man, I just love it. It just feels like the early 80s LA, like in a way that like you saw in movies that you know, if you grew up in the 80s, you probably didn't live it, but you certainly saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, as a kid of the 80s, I really enjoyed that aspect of it. But I wanted to get into talking about the overall trilogy here, Jeremy, because this is kind of a weird trilogy.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, there's definitely a through line of story here, and I want to take a little bit of an exception to something you said in the first segment that we spent talking about this movie, where you said that this movie tied more directly to X than Pearl did. I disagree with that.
Of course it does.
But, no, I disagree with that. I just think it ties
in. It directly references X at plotline-wise, it directly references X in a way that Pearl couldn't because it didn't exist yet.
I agree, except in terms of Maxine's story.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I think that Pearl is telling Pearl's story. And Pearl is an important part of X. So I think
Pearl an important part of Maxine?
Well, no, because that character's gone.
Yeah, right. We're on the same page.
I mean, to an extent.
You're not taking exception with what I'm saying. You're just adding to a different side of it. And I respect your contributions, but if you did not see X, you could have watched Pearl and not have missed anything. But if you did not see X, there are things that happen in Maxine that while they explain it, they directly are a result of what happened in X.
Yeah, but I think you could see Maxine without seeing X too.
Probably so. Yeah.
But that's one of the things that I wanted to point out here in talking about this overall trilogy, and that it's a really unique trilogy in that any one of these three movies can stand alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really unique trilogy in that while it is a trilogy and it is telling a through storyline of certain characters and events, these are three different movies.
Yeah, like, almost different genres.
Yeah, X is very much a 70s slasher in the tradition of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like, it's got that aesthetic. That's the aesthetic of that film is Texas Chainsaw. That, like,
you
very,
know,
very
I
roughly
gotta say
shot.
Real quick here, while I agree that it is definitely Texas Chainsaw, I don't know that I personally would say Texas Chainsaw is the template of the slasher in a way that like Friday the 13th is.
No, yeah, I agree with that entirely. I definitely think it's got more in common with a Friday the 13th or a Halloween in terms of the overall story of the film, but in terms of the look of the film, the way the film looks kind of almost documentary-ish and it's got that kind of grungy feel to it.
I think the aesthetic feels way more like that.
Yeah, the aesthetic is Texas Chainsaw. The aesthetic of Pearl is total like A24, you know, indie, like it's kind of horror, but kind of not too.
I heard them say like early Disney and Wizard of Oz were like touchstones when they were looking at how to create the kind of visual aesthetic. They considered doing it in black and white, but then the distributors were like, that wouldn't be commercially viable. People wouldn't watch that. So they went with the really saturated kind of Technicolor look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then hit me like when then Maxine is more like,
yeah, like I said earlier, Maxine is an 80s grindhouse vigilante revenge film.
Yeah.
It is, I mean, it is not, while there's certainly horrific stuff that happens in the film, and there is, you know, you made some references earlier to some specific horror directors and you know, scenes, and I mean, certainly the scene towards the beginning of the film where a guy attempts to assault her and she takes revenge on him, you know, in a very extreme way.
Hilarious.
Yeah, you know, that's absolutely a horror shot.
Yeah.
But I don't think that this is a horror film in that way. But it definitely has horror elements. But it's not a horror film the same way X was a horror film.
Yeah.
And I just think it's such an interesting thing that West has done here, where he's done these three films that are very much interconnected and very much have a story, but each one of them is a unique film.
And to your point, there's definitely a thematic through line through all of them, and it's kind of like the aspirations of fame and celebrity and what it means to be famous versus infamous and all of those kind of things. And Mia Goth, her performance as Pearl was just incredible. I think her performance as Maxine is equally interesting, if not explored quite in the same way as Pearl was. And I got to give a shout out to a guy named Corbin Stuckey, because he's the one that put the kernel in my mind, but he made a post that said, like, I like the story best in X, I like the character best in Pearl, and I like the setting best in Maxine. Huh. And I thought that was, like, pretty spot on.
Yeah, I don't think that's unreasonable. But I did really like the story, and I, you know, again, some of it is just the throwback of being, you know, a teenager in the 80s and growing
I'm
up
sure.
on movies like this that I shouldn't have been watching probably. But, you know, we had cable, so we had VHS.
Yeah. So another staple of our generation where we were watching R-rated movies like before we were 10. And I think that's a little different nowadays, for better or worse. I don't think it made either of us bad people, but we were definitely exposed to things, I think, at a pretty young age. And yeah, man, I really like this one. I guess without putting too fine a point on it, but you mentioned that this one might not be your favorite in the trilogy. If you were going to rank them, what would you say?
That's hard to say. I really like X and Pearl a lot, but I like them for different reasons. I like all three of them a lot. And I do think that Ty West really stuck the landing here.
I agree.
Overall, as much as I might say, yeah, maybe this isn't quite as good a film as the first two, I think it absolutely stuck the landing. This is an incredibly solid trilogy. I'm really interested to see what he does next. I just think that he is a really intelligent and interesting filmmaker in a way that maybe we haven't seen since Tarantino. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say he's the next Tarantino, but I mean, is he?
Yeah. Point taken. And I do think this trilogy in particular, if nothing else, as far as Ty West's career, it's put him in the zeitgeist in a way that none of his previous films have. I think House of the Devil and The Innkeepers are both five-star movies on their own. They're incredible, but stylistically and making movies that like resonate with a broad audience and get these theatrical releases that people actually show out to, the Maxine trilogy has been fantastic. And I agree. I don't know that I could rank them in a conventional sense, but I think if I were going to, it would probably be my least favorite would be, it's tough. My least favorite would be Maxine. My second would probably be X, and then I think my favorite of the three is probably Pearl.
Interesting.
But I don't know. I could feel differently tomorrow.
Well, we'll definitely mull this over some more, and I'm sure this is a film we're going to be talking about at the end of the year. We've got to take a break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Analysis channel on YouTube. And Jeremy, let's get caught up with House of the Dragon, which I know
my favorite part.
Both of us continue to very much enjoy on HBO and HBO Max. And yeah, I want to mention real quick before we get into that, there's been some news this week that a bunch of shows that are coming up that were announced as Max originals are now backtracking and are going to go on HBO Linear as well as being on Max. So much like House of the Dragon is like Game of Thrones was. It was, you know, it's shown on both Linear HBO and on Max, drops on Max at the same time the episode has its first airing on HBO. We're now going to see that with the forthcoming Harry Potter series. We're going to see that with the Penguin series with Colin Farrell. We're going to see that with Lanterns, the Green Lantern series that is part of James Gunn's DC Universe plans. We're going to see it with Welcome to Derry, which is a prequel to It.
Mm.
And there was one other in there too. Dune Messiah, the Dune prequel series. All of those series were originally announced as streaming on Max, and they're still going to stream on Max, but now they're going to be on Linear HBO as well. And it's an interesting strategy change, you know, as we watch what's becoming of, you know, peak television supposedly being over and the streaming world, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we're still going to get all those shows, so I guess nothing to complain about there. They're just going to be available to people that still have cable TV, as well as the streamers. So that's interesting. The strategy is obviously working for House of the Dragon. It is one of the most streamed shows, in addition to being, you know, a hit on Linear HBO. So I see no reason not to do that. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, it's almost as if they realize that HBO is what carries all of the prestige, and by like not going to the Max branding, they actually get to hold on to a little bit of that, as you said, you know, the era of prestige television. Like, this is a way to carry that forward without just completely looking like they're abandoning ship on that. But yeah, I guess I didn't even understand it in that way. So that's interesting. I thought they were just kind of branding them as HBO shows, but it makes sense when you say they're actually going to be putting them on the cable service and then also streaming them. So yeah, I think it really doesn't change a whole lot other than now it's got the HBO prestige to it. And that's what I think audiences and people who do like good TV kind of gravitate toward, you know.
It's going to be interesting to see if any of those series get that Sunday night prestige slot that House of the Dragon has, that The Last of Us has, that shows like historically like Game of Thrones and The Sopranos had. You know, if they place those shows in that Sunday night 8 p.m. Eastern slot or 9 p.m. Eastern slot, whatever it is, I think it's 9 p.m. Eastern, they're saying something with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
No, so, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to be very interested to see if that's the route they take with any of these shows. I suspect that Penguin is going to be the first one we're going to see. I don't think we're too far away from that at this point. So that's going to be very interesting. But moving on, you know, we've got a couple of episodes to catch up with, but I really wanted to just kind of very briefly get into what happened on the episode 2 weeks ago, ending with Alicent and Rhaenyra coming face-to-face for the first time in some time, when Rhaenyra makes a last-ditch effort at peace and realizes if she can meet face-to-face with Alicent, and Alicent probably doesn't want war either, that she may be able to avert it. And we get this revelation that we knew already, but that Alicent didn't know, and that's that Alicent misunderstood what Viserys was saying as he passed, and did not want Aegon to be put on the throne.
Yeah, and, yeah, this is a great scene that's not featured in Fire and Blood. Obviously, conversations that are had between two people that aren't like a public spectacle that the maesters would have information to. they wouldn't have been able to include it in the story, but I think it adds an extra kind of layer of complexity and puts these two actors in the same place at the same time earlier in the series, which is good.
You see that recognition on Allison's face that she was wrong, and then she chooses violence anyway.
And so equally meaningful, I think, is the fact that Rhaenyra is vindicated, and you see the expression on her face when she realizes that actually her father didn't want to kind of usurp her as the heir. And while she suspected that and felt that the whole time, it was the realization that it was about the Song of Ice and Fire that, like, really made her, like, galvanized her belief. But I don't know that Alicent chose violence so much as she was just indicating that violence was chosen for them. It's these men that sit at the council that don't respect either of them as true leaders anyways, that keep making these brass decisions. It was Rhaenys that suggested that she went and talked to Alicent in the first place. So the wisdom of an older woman was the one that kind of tried to put them on a path for peace. And then we just constantly see people like, I mean, Aegon, that it just makes these brash and kind of prideful decisions to go to war when obviously that's not the best solution for anybody.
Aemon and Daemon, who are very clearly mirror images of each other, and that was something that we saw it you know, basically spelled out for us in this last episode, where Daemon is having visions, and in one of the visions he sees himself as Aemon.
Yeah, and spooky hair and all.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was very interesting. But, you know, you talked about, so you've got that element of the Second Sons that are, you know, hungry for power. And you've got that element of the women who are trying to, you know, show wisdom. And, of course, then the big thing is we lose that wisdom in this episode. This latest episode. Because we have this heartbreaking battle where the Dance of Dragons finally really starts, and we're seeing dragon on dragon action, and we lose Rhaenys.
It's a very powerful scene. The way that all of that stuff is depicted, and they lean into it heavily in this series, that the dragons were kind of like the atomic option, and that they were kind of hoping that the fear of mutually assured destruction would keep them from acting on the impulse to bring out the dragons. But then a drunken Aegon decides he's going to go all in. And not only that, but they laid a trap where Aemon was going to come in with Vhagar anyways. So, like, the choice has been made, the nukes have been busted out, and the casualties are great. But yeah, like you said, the biggest loss I think that we're suffering is the wisdom and the experience of Rhaenys Targaryen.
Well, we also have this element where Aemon also attacks Aegon.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's right.
And, you know, it's not 100% clear whether he was attacking, that Aemon was just in the way when he was trying to attack Rhaenys, or whether he was trying to kill his brother and take power. And I think he was. Yeah. I mean, I think the torment that Aemon has received all his life from Aegon, up to and including the previous episode where he taunts him in the brothel. You know, I don't think Aemon much, you know, and there we've got that great scene also in the small council in this episode where Aemon taunts his brother by speaking to him in High Valyrian, which he can barely speak, which is supposed to be the language of the kings, and Aegon really can't speak it. You know, I don't think that was a coincidence. I think Aemon thinks he'd be a better king, and he might be right.
He would, I think, just in terms of, like, knowledge, Aemon was a serious person. Aegon was never a serious person. But I have to wonder here at the end of the episode, is this the last we see of Aegon? Did Aegon indeed die, or is he just going to be some burned to a crisp, holding on for dear life in the next episode kind of situation?
My assumption is that it's going to be the latter. I don't think Aegon is dead. From my limited knowledge of the books, I definitely don't think Aegon is dead.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the person that he is after this is going to be anybody that we want anything to do with. And things are, I mean, it's Game of Thrones. Things are getting worse.
And they're only going to continue to. But yeah, I feel like this was probably my favorite episode of the series so far. I mean, I know a large part of that is because we do finally get that epic battle scene that's kind of been building up over the last two episodes or two seasons. But there's some just really interesting emotional and character stuff going on right now. And I feel like this right here was the official sounding bell of like, now it's on.
Well, and we're halfway through the season now, so it's going to be interesting to see where we go from here and how much of this season is going to be war and how much of this is going to continue to be the buildup. But we'll have four more episodes to find that out, and we'll look forward to watching every single one of those for sure. Jeremy, next week we're going to get caught up on The Boys as we reach the season finale, so if you're wondering about that, we'll get to that next week. We have got to go for this week. Until then, you're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.